country headlines. Iran and Russia welcomed the Arab League's decision to readmit Syria into the bloc after its suspension more than a decade ago. UK's anti-monarchists say heavy-handed policing of King Charles III's coronation shows that there is no right to peaceful protest in Britain. And U.S. police confirmed the identity of the assailant in the recent mass shooting at a mall in Texas, with media saying that he may have had far-right links. Thanks for joining us. Iran and Russia have welcomed the Arab League's decision to readmit Syria into the body 12 years after its suspension. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman congratulated Damascus on the development. Nasser Kanani said settlement of differences among Muslim countries helps promote stability and calm in the region. Kanani added that such an approach reduces foreign interventions in regional affairs. Russia's Foreign Ministry also issued a statement saying that Moscow welcomes what he called the long-awaited step. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also earlier hailed Syria's return to the Arab League. The movement called on Muslim countries to strengthen bonds of friendship and take a harder stance against Israel's expansionist projects. Iran has strongly condemned the silence of the so-called advocates of human rights in the face of Israel's daily killing of Palestinians. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said assassination and massacre of Palestinian activists and ordinary people is now the order of the day for Zionists. He emphasized that international organizations, particularly the UN Security Council, are legally responsible for supporting the Palestinian nation in the face of the occupying regime. Iran's reaction came just one day after three Palestinian youths were killed by Israeli forces and settlers across the occupied territories. The regime has ramped up attacks on Palestinian towns and cities in recent months. More than 110 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank alone since the beginning of this year. Iran's women ice hockey team have finished runner-up in the 2023 Asia and Oceania Championship Finals. The team came second in the final match after losing to Thailand 3-1 on Sunday. The Iranian team made it to the final after winning five games in a row. They eliminated Singapore in the semifinals. This was the first time the Iranian women took part in the IIHF Women's Asia and Oceania Championship. The sports event started on April 30 in the Thai capital Bangkok and finished on May 7. Fifth edition of Export Capabilities of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iran Expo 2023, has kicked off in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Hundreds of foreign investors from different countries have participated in this year's event to assess opportunities for cooperation with Iranian companies. Mahdi Abbasian has more.
The fifth Export Potential Exhibition of the Islamic Republic of Iran, dubbed Iran Expo 2023, has officially kicked off in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi inaugurated the exhibition. During his speech, Raisi hailed Iran's progress despite sanctions, saying Iranian scientists and industrialists have managed to make great achievements. He also said that the Iranian government has set a 40-year record exporting over $50 billion worth of commodities since August 2021 when his government came into power. Since the early hours of the opening, the exhibition salons were packed with investors and business people from every corner of the world.
We have come from Burkina Faso and are very happy to participate in the Iran Expo exhibition. Our area of activity is processed agricultural products. This event has brought together a lot of businessmen and entrepreneurs from around the world. It's our honor to be part of this expo.
We come here to Iran many times, and it's safe, and it's nice people here, and we are like a brother. No any problems. Actually, I encourage people to come here to Iran. It's a very fantastic country.
Representatives from 60 foreign countries have participated in this year's event. The UAE, Pakistan, Russia, Turkey, and China are among the countries taking part in the exhibition. There are a total of 750 domestic companies and representatives at the event that have put their products on display in different industrial, medical, and petrochemical areas, as well as home appliances and food industries. The fifth Export Potential Exhibition of the Islamic Republic of Iran showcases the trade and investment opportunities in the country for foreign businessmen and entrepreneurs.
I want to thank the Iranian authorities for having the great idea of holding this exhibition. We are interested in cooperation with lots of companies here, especially pharmaceutical procedures, as well as those involved in construction.
We are here from China, and our country has very good diplomatic relations with Iran. China is also vigorously promoting partnership with Iranian companies. We hope that Iran continues its path of progress, and today we're here to see the products Iranian companies can export to China.
The exhibition will be held from May 7th to 10th. Iranian officials have estimated that the expo will help add more than $2 billion to the country's export revenues.
Iran Expo 2023 provides a platform, a perfect platform for investment in non-oil industries of Iran. And the presence of thousands of people in this year's event highlights this fact. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Hundreds of people marched in Paris to demand justice in the case of three teenagers allegedly hit by a police car in mid-April. Protesters held signs and chanted slogans to condemn police violence. During the demonstration, family members of the kids called out the police, hurting the people that they should be protecting. They said such incidents must not happen again. One of the children, aged 13, 14, and 17, remains hospitalized in a serious condition. Paris prosecutor's office says that three officers have been suspended. Over the past months, the French police have also been criticized for the use of excessive force during the pension reform protests. Police also face allegations of attacks on migrants, racial profiling, and religious intolerance. UK's anti-monarchists have criticized the heavy-handed policing of King Charles III's coronation. They say that there is no longer a right to peaceful protest in Britain after dozens of protesters were arrested and detained into the night. The detainees included Graham Smith, who leads the anti-monarchy group Republic. In a statement, Smith said his arrest was predetermined and would have occurred regardless of any evidence or action. He added that the arrests were not about protecting people from harm, but about protecting the king from embarrassment. London's Metropolitan Police said a total of 64 arrests were made during the Coronation Day protests. The detainees' charges included the breach of peace and conspiracy to cause a public nuisance.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know? Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why there are many mainstream platforms. So what the royal family stand for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
The U.S. president has once again called on Congress to move to curb access to guns following the mass shooting at a mall in Texas in the weekend. Joe Biden is seeking a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Biden also called for universal background checks and an end to immunity for gun manufacturers. On Saturday, a gunman went on a shooting spree at a busy mall north of the city of Dallas, killing 8 people and injuring 7 others. Police said the motive was unclear. This comes as reports say the social media accounts of the shooter contained hundreds of posts with racially or ethnically motivated content and violent far-right rhetoric. The reports say the Dallas residents may have been linked to white supremacists or neo-Nazi groups. At least 7 people have been killed and several others injured after an SUV plowed into pedestrians in the U.S. city of Brownsville in Texas. Police say the male driver of the car is now in custody. He's charged with reckless driving and could face additional charges. The victims, who included migrants, were waiting at a bus stop near a shelter for the homeless when the crash happened. It is not clear whether the driver crashed into the group intentionally or lost control of the vehicle. Investigations are underway. The city of Brownsville, on the border with Mexico, is expecting an influx of migrants after COVID-era restrictions expire on Thursday. The death toll from recent floods and landslides in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo has risen to nearly 400. Heavy rainfall in the Kalehe region on Thursday caused rivers to overflow, inundating several villages. Many homes were washed away and crop fields were devastated. Local authorities say that they have sent boats filled with supplies and medicine for the survivors. The government has declared Monday as a national day of mourning. The disaster came just 2 days after floods killed at least scores of people and destroyed thousands of homes in neighboring Rwanda. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has offered his condolences to the families of the victims in both countries. He blamed the tragic event on negligence to global warming. DR Congo is among the poorest countries in the world, riddled by corruption and conflict in the east. The Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida is in South Korea at the official invitation of President Yoon Suk-yeol. This is the first visit by a Japanese leader to South Korea since 2011. The trip comes as anti-Japan sentiments run high in South Korea over historical and territorial disputes still unresolved for many South Koreans. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida became the first Japanese leader to visit South Korea for a bilateral summit after 12 years. Despite ongoing historical disputes, President Yoon has reached out to Tokyo with plans to possibly include Japan in its alliance with the U.S.
Both countries are exposed to North Korea's nuclear threats, and the military cooperation is needed more than ever. The Washington Declaration at the moment is an agreement between South Korea and the U.S., but we do not rule out the possibility of Japan's participation.
Japanese Prime Minister Kishida sought to reassure South Koreans over the impending release of contaminated water from the 2011 nuclear disaster. He also welcomed the opportunity for Japan to participate in a network of military alliances.
North Korea continues to carry out provocations in the region, and there is a sign that there is an attempt to change the current status by force. Based on this assessment, we agreed we have to strengthen deterrence and ability to respond to threats through Japanese-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-U.S. alliance, the South Korea-Japanese alliance, and the trilateral alliance.
Both supporters and detractors rallied outside the presidential compound. Many opposed President Yoon's outreach to Japan and militaristic pro-U.S. policies and questioned his patriotism.
Is President Yoon Suk-yeol, who is driving the Korean Peninsula towards Cold War confrontation while taking the lead in representing the interests of the United States and Japan, is he really the president of South Korea?
South Koreans have also been critical of President Yoon for creating a South Korean foundation to compensate victims of Japan's colonial rule. Improved relations between South Korea and Japan will no doubt be welcomed by the U.S., which wants to see a strengthened trilateral military alliance. And despite domestic opposition, President Yoon seems fully committed.
with the largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises slated to start later this month. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Such fears mount in Germany as industrial production in Europe's top economy sees an unexpected decline. Official data shows production in manufacturing, energy, and construction dropped 3.4% in March compared with the previous month. It swung from an upward increase of over 2% in February. The automotive industry was a major contributor to the recent drop. The automobile sector is a pillar of Germany's economy. It is hammered by high energy prices following the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Shanghai Cooperation Organization nations account for 40% of the world population and also a third of global GDP. With broad representation and solid strength, the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, has a bright future and will play a greater role in major international and regional issues. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times reported, Chinese State Councillor and Foreign Minister Ken Gang has called on the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, to build a closer SCO community with a shared future at a time when the world faces challenges and crises, including the resurgence of the Cold War mentality, surging unilateral protectionism, and rising hegemonism, while proposing a five-point suggestion at the SCO Foreign Ministers' meeting in Goa, India. Chinese experts hailed the SCO meeting as a success that fully demonstrated the attraction of the SCO philosophy, namely promoting regional stability and development through equality and mutually beneficial cooperation, openness, and inclusiveness. This is in a stark contrast to the confrontational mindset and black politics of some Western politicians. In the context of the intensifying game between major powers, maintaining the momentum of SCO solidarity and cooperation is of great significance to global governance as well as the process of multipolarization, they said. During the two-day event, SCO members agreed to further strengthen security cooperation and jointly fight terrorism, separationism, drug trafficking, and cyber crimes. They also agreed to promote cooperation in the fields of transport, energy, finance, investment, free trade, and digital economy, as well as environmental protection and jointly deal with the climate change, according to a readout from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. On regional issues, SCO members support Afghanistan in achieving national stability and reconstruction, support the SCO in strengthening cooperation with the UN and BRICS, safeguard the principles of the UN Charter, and uphold multilateralism. They agreed to strengthen the establishment of a regional anti-terrorist structure. All parties agreed to advance the SCO enlargement process in an orderly manner and further enhance the international influence of the SCO. According to reports, Iran and Belarus are expected to be the newest SCO members in the future. The SCO Foreign Ministers' meeting has made comprehensive preparations for the SCO summit to be held in New Delhi in July, according to the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Li Yongkun, director of the Eurasian Social Development Research at the Development Research Center of the State Council, told the Global Times recently that the consensus reached by SCO foreign ministers showed that the SCO member states are as committed as ever to cooperation in security and, at the same time, hope to make breakthroughs in new areas such as cyberspace and supply chains. The consensus shows that the SCO's philosophy and development prospects have been fully recognized by its member states and reflects the SCO's role as an important multilateral platform for practical cooperation and communication among countries. Zhao Hirong, an Eastern European studies expert from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, told the Global Times recently. Ken stressed the need to carry forward the Shanghai spirit or the undergirding values and guidelines for the SCO, featuring mutual trust, mutual benefit, equality, consultation, respect for diversity of civilizations, and pursuit of common development recently. With that premise, Ken called on SCO members to uphold the strategic autonomy, strengthen unity and mutual trust, and oppose external forces meddling in regional affairs and instigating color revolutions. Ken also suggested continuing to deepen security cooperation and resolutely cracking down on all forms of terrorism, drug trafficking, and transnational organized crime. He also suggested that SCO members resolutely resist any action that undermines the international economic and trade order and market rules, and that the stability of industrial and supply chains be maintained. During the two-day event, a series of bilateral meetings were held in a frank manner at the SCO meeting platform, which analysts viewed as a convincing response to the West's sour grapes and attempts to smear and sow discord among SCO members. Chinese State Councillor and Foreign Minister Ken Gang met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on the sidelines of the SCO Foreign Minister's meeting recently, during which the two sides agreed to maintain the overall unity and cooperation of the SCO and build the SCO into a platform for mutually beneficial cooperation among member states. They also exchanged views on the Ukraine crisis. When meeting with Indian External Affairs Minister Subrahmanyan, Ken said the two sides should continue to make efforts to further ease the situation on the China-India border in order to maintain sustainable peace and stability in the region. Pakistani Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari also spoke with Lavrov in a bilateral meeting, and the two sides exchanged views on the situation in Afghanistan, according to media reports. As the foreign minister from the host country, Jay Shankar also spoke with his counterparts from China, Russia, and Uzbekistan on the sidelines of the SCO meeting on topics ranging from bilateral and multilateral cooperation to global and regional issues, according to ANI News. Although no bilateral foreign ministers meeting was held between Pakistan and India, according to Indian media, Jay Shankar welcomed Zardari, the first visiting Pakistani high-ranking official in nearly a decade. Analysts from Channel News Asia see it as a small but crucial progress in their relationship. It is natural for different countries to have differences. It is precisely because of the existence of the SCO that member states can better manage differences and common challenges through dialogue and cooperation rather than through hegemonic coercion, Zhao noted. Meanwhile, Tehran Times reported recently Iranian Defense Minister Mohammad Reza Ashtiani took part in a meeting of defense ministers of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in India recently. The Iranian defense minister met with his Belarusian and Indian counterparts on the sidelines of the SCO meeting. Referring to the meeting of the President of Iran and the Prime Minister of India at the summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Uzbekistan, Ashtiani said, "These connections are very valuable and must be developed and strengthened." He stated, "Today, Shanghai has become an influential organization in global developments and equations, whose expansion and strengthening can be an effective measure in promoting and advancing multilateralism in the international arena." The defense chief added, "It is only in light of interaction and cooperation between countries that we can deal with common security challenges and threats in the region and the world." According to Ashtiani, the SCO is one of the most important security arrangements in the world to establish stability and security. Underlying that, the successful holding of the SCO defense ministers shows the important and effective role of the Indian government in maintaining regional and global peace, stability, and security, the Iranian defense minister said. The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to strengthen its defense and military cooperation with the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, especially the Indian Armed Forces.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. In this edition, foreign ministers of the Arab League member states have agreed to reinstate Syria's membership after its suspension more than 10 years ago. The turn of events comes amid a flurry of regional normalization of ties with Damascus in recent weeks. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the significance of this development ahead of the Arab League summit, which is set to be held in Saudi Arabia on May 19th. What this means for the region and for the world. To do so, we're joined by Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, who is joining us live from Beirut. We also have with us Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, who is joining us from Manchester.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Maarouf from Beirut. Mr. Maarouf, Syria's Arab League membership was revoked in 2011. What was the reason behind this in the first place?
Clearly, the reason behind it was the pressure of the United States on its local vessels to push out Syria, who was defending itself against an invasion by Wahhabi death squads, funded by the local vessels of the United States and backed by the CIA. Today, what we see is a return of the Arab League to Syria. It is not a return of Syria to the Arab League. It's a return of the Arab League to Syria and a return of all those countries that at one moment over those 11 years harmed Syria, coming back for ending those hostilities and almost begging for goodwill. And so now we see the importance of geography in the sense that Ibn Khaldun will tell us the fate that is written for Damascus because of its geographic location. The region cannot have a balance without Damascus being at the center of it. And of course, we see the Arab League coming back to Damascus. We see Turkey attempting to end its hostilities with Syria and a blossoming of the axis of resistance led with Iran the president arriving in the last 2 days to Damascus also. So that's the importance of geography and the fate of the country of Syria.
Exactly. Those are very important issues you just mentioned. And 2023 seems to be a year of turning a new page, if you will, for regional developments as far as Syria is concerned. Let's bring in Mr. Ford. Mr. Ford, can you shed more light on the geostrategic location of Syria? And why didn't these countries consider this in the first place when they decided that Syria should not be part of the Arab League? Didn't they know how important Syria was? What did they have in mind back then?
Well, I think they had been deceived by the United States, which was telling them that, according to U.S. intelligence, the Assad government was bound to fall. It was just a matter of time. And the Arab states, or many of them, thought that they would join the U.S. push to overthrow the government of Syria. Some of them, let's not forget, also were supporting very actively some of the Gulf countries, particularly, were supporting the armed opposition groups. So they wanted to isolate Syria anyway. But a big factor was the U.S. pressure on Arab states.
So, Mr. Ford, do you believe that Bashar Assad's, let's say, the way he has solidified his position in Syria is the reason why these Arab countries are turning back towards Syria?
That's a big part of the reason, but there are other factors in play. It's very interesting now we're seeing the Arab world, led particularly by Saudi Arabia, in a new partnership with Cairo, more defiant towards America, no longer prepared to be dictated to by the United States. Believe me, this development is a bitter blow for the United States. They tried to pressure countries like Jordan, weaker countries, not to join in the consensus, but this failed. This year, partly as a result of the geopolitical situation with Ukraine, partly because of general U.S. Weakness and failure, from Afghanistan through Ukraine and their China policy, the Arab countries are more ready to be independent, and that means readmitting Syria to the Arab League and, for most of them, normalizing relations.
So, Mr. Maruf, in your opinion, well, Saudi Arabia, we do know that it had long resisted normalization of ties with Damascus. Why this change of heart at this point in time?
As our guest mentioned just a minute ago, the international scene changing, the end of American hegemony and the rise of multipolarity. And we have to actually credit Syria for this rise of the new world of multipolar reality. Without the wall of Damascus, without the government of Syria, the military of Syria, the structures of Syria withstanding this 11 years of war and this international coalition that the United States led invading the country, Russia wouldn't be in a position today to actually defend itself, for instance, in Ukraine. Imagine if those Wahhabi death squads that the United States on Syria, if they survived, where they would be today and how they would be moved, as we see the Nazi militias being moved to the Ukraine. So Syria was actually the beginning of this multipolar world. It's the time when Russia took a position to finally intervene militarily in a location where the United States was invading with its proxies. So this is where we're at, and the world is changing. The Arab countries that may have been vessels of the United States for a good of 80 somewhat years since the end of World War I, World War II, are now finding themselves in a position where the United States cannot protect them, and their economic future is tied to Asia and Africa, not to Europe and North America. And that's why we see the shift. And of course, that increases the possibility that these former vassal states like the Saudi country, Arabia, or the United Arab Emirates, or others that are normalizing with Syria right now, will have a colored revolution plotted against it by the United States any minute now.
So, Mr. Ford, Mr. Maruf did point out that there is a new world order that is emerging. Do you believe that the United States is losing its grip on the Eastern Hemisphere with its plots have failed regarding Syria?
Absolutely, losing its grip. As the previous speaker just said, the United States push for global power more or less came to an end in about 2014, by which time it was beginning to fail in Syria. Syria had withstood the incoming tide from the U.S.-supported Arab Spring, and the tide had come to its highest point. And the same could be said about Ukraine. 2014 was an important year there also. And so everything we've seen in the last 9 years has been a weakening of the U.S. Stranglehold over the Middle East. There have been other important milestones as well, like the tanker war in the Gulf in about 2018. Which saw, among other things, an attack on a Saudi refinery. This proved that America could not defend its allies, and those allies, like Saudi Arabia, have now become realistic, are making peace with their old enemies, like Iran, and have realized that the best way to have security is not to have enemies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Maruf, Saudi Arabian Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan visited Damascus last month for the first time in more than a decade. The two countries have decided to reopen their embassies, restore flights between the two countries. What is the significance of this escalation in bilateral ties, this rapprochement, if you will?
Well, basically, Saudi Arabia currently is the biggest financier and of most of the Arab states, let's say. And that's why we see the Arab League right now jumping very fast into returning Syria into the organization, because Saudi Arabia said so. And it means also the same thing for the Gulf states and the Gulf Cooperation Council. What Saudi Arabia says to these countries happens. So what does this mean? This means that right now, we will see an acceleration of this normalization between all the Arab states and Syria, the former states that stayed out of Syria since 2011. And partially, we will see some of those states paying a price for it, as we see Egypt already paying a price for that reality with the war in Sudan being instigated by the United States and Israel to weaken it in this state. So we will see an increase of probable problems in those countries that are now normalizing with Syria by the United States pressure. And as you know, the reality is that Syria will be the winner of this no matter what. And it shows that resistance to American invasions is the right way to go. And it's worse to be a friend of the United States than to be an enemy.
Interesting. So, Mr. Ford, Jordan, Kuwait, and Qatar oppose Bashar al-Assad's presence in the Arab League. What are the reasons behind that, and how do you foresee the future for these three countries?
Well, each one of those is different. Jordan is weak, less able to withstand U.S. Pressure. Qatar has its particular problems with Saudi Arabia and never wants to follow a Saudi lead, that there is a struggle between the petrol superpower, Saudi Arabia, and the gas superpower, Qatar. And at the moment, the Saudis are winning. Kuwait has always been a maverick, but thankfully, does not have huge significance today. What matters now is Saudi leadership. We will, in a matter of days, by May 19, the Arab summit, we will see Assad, no doubt, being welcomed at the Arab League summit in Riyadh. This will be a bitter blow for the United States. And it's also very important for what happens now inside Syria. The opposition, what's left of it, will be even more demoralized. The momentum now is all with the Syrian government. No doubt after the Turkish elections, the Turks will withdraw their troops from Syria. And all that remains then is for the armed opposition groups to negotiate terms of surrender. And this will leave the United States isolated as the remaining holdout.
So, Mr. Maruf, we discussed a new world order emerging, and of course, Mr. Ford also shed more light on the role that the United States used to play in the region and how that role has diminished. Now let's put Iran in the mix. Let's not forget that all of this is happening while Saudi Arabia and Iran have also reestablished their diplomatic ties and they're growing closer. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited Damascus just a few days ago, and that was, of course, a historic visit after nearly 12 years, a very important visit with lots of agreements being signed, bilateral relations expanding, particularly in trade and business. Tell us, what role does Iran play in this entire equation?
Well, of course, that visit was historic, and it solidified the alliance between Syria and Turkey that has been unshakable since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And it was also a signal to the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, who may think that opening up the Arab League and some rebuilding and connections with Syria may sway Syria away from its brotherly relationship with Iran, that this will never happen. Of course, we must remember that Syria, in multiple times over the last, 20-somewhat years since the invasion of Iraq, has been pressured and by the United States and offered much wealth and much trade if it gives up both the resistance in Lebanon and its relationship with Iran, and that never happened even under the pressures of the war that lasted 10 years on Syria. So this is a very important, also significance for Iran to show this relationship, how for anybody else around the region, to show how this brotherly relationship is extendable to anybody, that we don't need foreign imperial forces in the region to safeguard everybody's security, and that only relationships that are brotherly between the nations of the region will guarantee that security. This is the significance of that visit.
That's an interesting point you raise there. So, Mr. Ford, it seems that the divide and rule policy that the West particularly has been trying to implement in the Eastern Hemisphere is now failing. Can you shed more light on that and, of course, Iran's role in this entire normalization of ties that we see?
Well, what's happened has been a victory for steadfastness. The Arabs call it sumud, steadfastness. And there's a steadfastness front, which includes Syria and Iran and Hezbollah and some of the Palestinian groups. And they have shown patience over the last 12 years, patience which is now being rewarded at great speed. The momentum now is all with the resistance front, the steadfastness front, and the absolute pivot for this has been Iran. Without Iran, Syria would have fallen by 2014 or earlier. This on the part of the United States, Syria was always the war against Syria by America was always just a prelude to and part of the war against Iran. It was a way primarily to weaken Iran, ready for changing the government of Iran. Well, it's all come to nothing. It's now crumbling in a really embarrassing way. And this is why the United States is so angry tonight.
Thank you very much, Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, joining us live from Manchester, and Leith Maarouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight, and I'm very grateful that you shared your thoughts and views with us in this edition.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering a doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan. La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the Holy Quran and the variety of the topics that are in this holy book. Now, one question is that sometimes we face different topics and different stories in one single surah of the Holy Quran. Why is it so?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The main answer to this question is that we know that the Holy Book of Quran was revealed gradually during 23 years of the mission of the Holy Prophet in different occasions, in different places. And that is why we see that, I mean, it was not revealed as all at once, for the people. I mean, we shouldn't think that, an author, for example, he writes a book on philosophy and everything is on philosophy and people can find chapters, titles, subtitles, and so on and so forth. But the Noble Book of Quran is revealed during 23 years on many, many different occasions. And in each occasion, some verses are revealed to the Prophet. And then after the instruction, after all the verses are revealed, under the instruction of the Prophet, the verses are put together to, constitute the chapters. Now, the main point about the Noble Book of Quran is guiding the human being. So Quran is not a book of philosophy, for example, or only about moral issues, or only about Islamic laws, or it's not about a book of science. Quran has paid attention to many fields of study, but the main point is that Quran is revealed to guide the human beings. It's not only about Islamic law. It's not only about beliefs. It's not only about moral issues. Quran has everything, but we cannot reduce the Quran to only one of the fields. So, yes, if the Quran was only a book of history, we should claim that then it was better for the Quran to have, chapters based on chronology, titles, subtitles, or if it was only about Islamic laws, we can expect the Quran to be based on some, table of contents, and so on and so forth. No, Quran has a very unique style. And according to many scholars, this is one of the points that make the Quran unique, and no one can imitate it and bring even one chapter like the Quran. As you rightly mentioned, the Quran in one chapter may refer to different points. But those people who know the style of the Quran and they know the Arabic language, no one finds a kind of inconsistency in the verses of the Quran. And according to some great scholars of interpretation of the Quran, all the verses are of a chapter are related in one way or another to each other. Although apparently at the first glance they may seem to be irrelevant to each other, but after further contemplation we come to this understanding that no, they are related to each other.
So even if the story changes, the same topic is over there? The general topic is
no,
over
the
there?
No, the topic even might change. Allama Tabatabai mentions in many cases that, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is talking about one issue, one topic, one story, and then goes to the topic of, for example, monotheism or akhlaq. But after further contemplation, you find a relation between that story and the next topic. Mm-hmm. But it is in need of